The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 271, a panel entitled Seeing the Seer with New Eyes, Revisioning Joseph Smith, with Maxine Hanks, D. Michael Quinn, Lance S. Owens, and G. Benson Whittle.
I want to welcome you all to Sunstone Session 271, Seeing the Seer with New Eyes, Revisioning Joseph Smith. Almost from the beginning, Joseph Smith was a polarizing figure. Either revered as a prophet who saw God, entertained angels, and received divine revelation, or accused by critics of fabricating fictional scripture, indulging in vain imagination, deception, or fraud. This polarization continues today, 180 years after his initial claims. Joseph Smith is often seen in exclusive or absolute terms by both followers and detractors as either God's prophet or an egotistical plagiarist. While believers accept Joseph as a prophet, they may shun notions of his subjectivity, fallibility, or creativity, or his participation in any paradigm other than a Mormon one, or perhaps even mysticism itself. Meanwhile, many critics acknowledge Joseph's creative processes, but condemn them or his intuitive processes as fabrication and his work as fantasy. Yet there are still other levels of appreciation and critique as well, which see Joseph's work as more complex than an either-or choice of fact or fraud. These views see it as more than history, literal reality, and more than environment or social influences. Some believers and critics alike take Joseph's creative and visionary processes quite seriously and regard his religion-making as something more than simple fiction. In the past two decades, groundbreaking views by scholars such as D. Michael Quinn, Harold Bloom, John L. Brook, Jan Shipps, Lance Owens, William Moraine, Mark Thomas, Benson Whittle, Jess Grosbeck, Robert Price, and many others, including the most recently, I think, Richard Bushman, have repositioned Joseph Smith as a visionary, intuitive voice working within alternative or other or larger frameworks, paradigms, worldviews, or traditions, including transnationality or transnational identity experience, heresy, charisma, new religious tradition, old esoteric tradition, hermeticism, the magic worldview, creative imagination, literary genius, myth, mysticism, or visionary experience. In fact, just this May at the Library of Congress, during the Worlds of Joseph Smith conference, Richard Bushman gave a stellar paper which called for a view of Joseph beyond that of being simply a product of 19th century America and its influences. He talked about the transnational Joseph Smith with a history beyond the United States. And he cited and praised scholars who had taken what he called a transnational approach or viewed Joseph in a transnational setting, including John L. Brook, Harold Bloom, Jan Shipps, and Michael Quinn. He praised these scholars as seeing Joseph as more than and Joseph and Mormonism as more than a Yankee religion run amok. He said Joseph, he described this view as seeing Joseph as more than American. Something in him transcended his time and place. Bushman lauded Bloom particularly. By setting Smith against ancient religious traditions, Bloom discovers a Joseph Smith never fully seen before, a man in touch with religious currents from a deep past. As I listened to Richard Bushman give his paper, I found it thrilling in its own right. as taking a much more whole and complex approach to Joseph, but also because it validates and even comes close to taking some of the same approach taken by the members of this panel in the past, many years earlier in the 1980s or early 90s. This is an approach that values both sides of Joseph, the spiritual and the human, or perhaps all sides of Joseph, including the creative and the intuitive and the psychic. Bushman acknowledged both the divine and human sources acting upon Joseph. Each of our panelists has seen and contextualized Joseph Smith as working from both spiritual and social influences, working within frameworks outside the Orthodox Mormon view, and as accessing alternative worldviews and working within those other contexts. Each panelist has tried to share these worldviews as viable contexts, worthwhile paradigms in which to view and understand Joseph. I also want to mention that at that same Washington, D.C. conference, Grant Underwood warned us all about the dangers of parallelism. Where parallels are drawn too easily or too quickly, particularly if people are well-versed in one paradigm but not equally well-versed in the other. Although I thought he seemed to have John L. Brooke in mind when he was making this caution. And I would say that our panelists are well-versed in the paradigms, both Mormon and alternative, within which they evaluate Joseph Smith, which is one of the things that makes our panelists unique and one of the reasons why I invited them here. They seem to have done a fair amount of work in both the Mormon and alternative worldviews that they explore in their work, and I think are uniquely qualified to comment on both worldviews and their intersections. I've worked with these three panelists in a variety of endeavors over the past two decades. They've each mentored me in a number of ways. Each one of them is a true friend and a soulmate on my path in life. Each is a Renaissance master in his own right, mastering multiple fields of inquiry. And we're all connected in all kinds of ways over the years. Our work has influenced each other. For example, Mike Quinn's 1987 book on early Mormonism and the magic worldview influenced Lance Owens to write his articles on Joseph Smith, or had a role in that, and also influenced Ben Whittle to write an interpretive essay on Mike's book, which Ben and I discussed and collaborated on with me as editor while I was helping Ben do stonemasonry at Scott Kinney's house. And that essay of Ben's ended up being a major feature in the final chapter of John L. Brooke's book, which just escaped me. The Refiner's Fire, thank you, where Mike's book and mine are also mentioned in that same chapter, and which appeared nearly simultaneously with Lance Owens' articles on Joseph Smith as a hermetic, America's hermetic prophet. So we all kind of converged at that same time with John L. Brooke's book in the last chapter. There are many connections between us, and our paths are parallel in some ways and intersect in others. So I'll introduce our panelists. We will first hear from D. Michael Quinn, who is a nationally known historian and author, PhD from Yale, former BYU professor, and now an independent scholar living in Southern California. Mike recently completed a year at Yale University as a senior fellow and postdoctoral associate in the history department. He's the author of several groundbreaking and celebrated books on Mormon history, which many of you are familiar with, including his groundbreaking Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, as well as his The Mormon Hierarchy, Volumes 1 and 2, and several other books. Mike is also a gifted photographer and a film addict, as well as a mean dancer. And I just wanted to share that the first time I saw Mike at the MHA in 1982, I had an experience, a spiritual experience, when I gazed upon his face. I felt that I saw the Imago Dei, the image of God, or the Imago Christi, the image of Christ in his countenance. Lance Owens is an emergency physician at Salt Lake Regional Medical Center, as well as at the VA hospital here in Salt Lake and other hospitals, including in Utah and California. Lance has a bachelor's degree in history, as well as doing graduate work, and also is a physician. He is a Gnostic priest of the Ecclesia Gnostica, celebrating Mass at the Holy Cross Chapel in Salt Lake. He's the author of two groundbreaking articles on Joseph Smith, the award-winning article and dialogue, Joseph Smith and Kabbalah, The Occult Connection, and Joseph Smith, America's Hermetic Prophet, published in Gnosis Magazine. Lance is also a world-class hiker, biker, and globe-trotting pilgrim. Lance has personally mentored me in the last 7 years on a very healing path of Gnosis, for which I'm eternally grateful for. G. Benson Whittle is a sculptor, carver, and artist with many works sold or exhibited in Utah, as well as some foreign countries. He has a bachelor's degree in Russian and did graduate work in Ireland and England, and I think dropped out of his PhD program at some point, but had enough work to have gotten one. He's an author of a variety of articles, including Le Petit Richards, which is a satire of Mormon culture, The Barbaric Carver, which is a study of carvings on medieval cathedrals, and The Sunstones of Nauvoo in Sunstone Magazine, as well as an oft-quoted and celebrated review essay on early Mormonism and the magic worldview published in BYU Studies. I wanted to say that Ben has made an extraordinary effort to be with us today. Ben recently, on June 30th, just less than 4 weeks ago, underwent neurosurgery to remove a tumor, which was completely successful. And he told me that it has confirmed that he is truly open-minded. He flew out here. What's that?
I was during the surgery because the
He flew out here to be with us today to escape treatments for a while. And he and his wife, Patricia Hatch, are like family to me, the type of people you choose as your family as opposed to the ones you're born with. And then I will, if there's time left, make a few comments at the end after these three panelists. Oh, you know, Ben, I wanted to say if you have any medical needs during the panel, we happen to have an emergency physician sitting next to you. So I try to plan for everything. I'm Maxine Hanks, a writer, and Dan Weatherspoon insists that I'm a mystic, author or co-author of 5 books, including Mormon Faith in America, a volume for teenagers, and author of many essays and articles, including The Nauvoo Temple as a Symbol of Wholeness, published in Sunstone Magazine, and The Moonstone Column in Sunstone. I'm a Gnostic, and that's not an agnostic, that's a Gnostic, engaged in liturgical and religious studies, particularly the sacred feminine, mysticism, archetype, and myth. I also happen to be a cousin of Joseph Smith, which is why I have an interest in him, and with whom I share a number of tendencies, including a capacity for vision and persecution, and a so-called Merovingian connection, and a natality or natal chart of a Christmas Cuspian Capricorn with Sagittarius rising. With that, I will turn it over to Michael.
Due to the abundance and variety of relevant evidence, faithful Mormon historians have publicly acknowledged for more than 2 decades that Joseph Smith Jr. and his parents manifested interest and participation in various dimensions of folk magic. This includes a 1984 book by Richard L. Bushman, who was at that time an LDS stake president, articles published in 1986 by BYU Studies, although dated 1984, a 1992 Deseret Book History of the LDS Church, plus 5 entries in the 1992 Encyclopedia of Mormonism, whose content received pre-publication approval by Apostles Neil A. Maxwell and Dallin H. Oakes. Although there are still naysayers, they have long been the Mormon equivalent of the Flat Earth Society. However, an issue of legitimate discussion or debate is the extent of interest and participation by Joseph Smith Jr., his father, and mother in mundane magic. This has certainly been a point of emphasis by previously cited LDS historians, most of whom have downplayed the frequency, extent, and longevity of folk magic as a subject of interest to the Smith family, particularly to the adult Joseph Jr. after 1830, even after 1827. Various sources indicate that Joseph Smith and his parents had extensive interest in the occult sciences, folk magic, and the esoteric. This continued for decades. New York neighbors testified that Lucy Mack Smith valued seer stones and performed palm readings. Palmyra convert Orrin Porter Rockwell later described how she used her dreams about buried treasures to direct Joseph Sr. and Jr. to locations where they used their respective gifts, their own respective gifts of divination in the treasure quest. Aside from dreams, Joseph Sr. regarded the divining rod as his main gift. Vermont neighbors referred to his using the rod before the birth of his namesake in 1805. New York neighbors said he was using a divining rod for the treasure quest shortly after his arrival in Palmyra in late 1816. And in 1829, his brother condemned Joseph Sr.'s continued devotion to it. A Mormon family testified that the elderly Smith patriarch consecrated divining rods and sanctioned the treasure quest as late as 1837 in Ohio. Among his possessions, which went to his patriarchal successor Hiram Smith in 1840, were parchments called laymans, inscribed with magic incantations and symbols for the treasure quest, according to instructions and illustrations published in 13 editions of Ebenezer Sibley's Complete Illustration of the Occult Sciences from 1784 to 1826. Under the tutelage of his father, Joseph Jr. began using a divining rod in early adolescence. By the time he was 11, folk magic and religion converged for him in Palmyra, where the 1817 revival first turned his attention toward, quote, the welfare of my soul, unquote. At the same time, he was assisting his father in using the rod as a divine instrument for treasure hunting. This first religious revival in the young boy's experience might have been what caused him to seek greater gifts of divination than his parents had ever experienced. And it is necessary to recognize that for many people, spiritual gifts and occult gifts were perceived as two sides of the same divine coin. Far more difficult than the passive experience of dreaming and the somewhat mechanical divination by rods, stone divination required visionaries called seers or peepers at the time. Although it required the external help of a special stone, both folklore and the occult publications specified that the gift of seeing resided within the stone seer and was not automatic for anyone looking into the same stone. Stone divination required effort, spiritual discipline, purity of heart, and special resonance of the individual with the metaphysical. Through their special stones, males and females, often young persons, pierced the veil separating the mundane from the spiritual by peering or peeping into another worldly dimension, which could give them insight, literally internal sight, of otherwise hidden things of this world and the next. According to his New York neighbors, by the fall of 1819, young Joseph was participating in stone divination. Some neighbors grudgingly admitted that Joe was successful in locating livestock and other lost items through stone seership. Buried treasures remained elusive, but he continued his seeric search. I do not regard it as coincidental that this change in Joseph Jr.'s emphasis on divination occurred at the same time as religious revivals were convulsing the region surrounding his village. A Methodist camp meeting revival occurred on the outskirts of Palmyra in 1820, apparently just before spring formally ended on June 21st. While exploring the metaphysical as a stone seer, he had the first of his theophanies as a religious seeker. This vision of deity at age 14 did not end his activities as a treasure seer. Why should it? In the midst of this quest, God appeared to him without disapproval, forgave his adolescent sins, and required nothing further of him, at least for the present, that present. Moreover, the teenager's seeric gifts brought to his poverty-stricken family extra income in the form of food and occasional coins from those eager for his services. Wealthier employers paid far more. At the height of his career, Joseph Jr. earned $14 a month as a treasure seer, considerably more than the monthly wage of grown men who dug the Erie Canal during the same time period. And so his treasure quest continued near home and in distant counties of New York and Pennsylvania as weather allowed. Although such activities involve both parents some of the time, their two oldest sons on occasion, and young Joseph much of the time, none of them neglected farm work. His mother insisted that, quote, "We never during our lives suffered one important interest to swallow up every other obligation," unquote, prefacing her remark with a reference to their, quote, "drawing magic circles," unquote, traditionally etched into the ground as part of treasure digging. Among the sacred relics, quote unquote, the dying patriarch Joseph gave to his oldest living son, Hiram, was the requisite dagger, inscribed with magic symbols according to occult handbooks available during the period. While there can be legitimate debate about the frequency that any member of the Smith family engaged in such activities in Palmyra and Manchester, New York, from 1817 to 1827, I think the evidence does allow certain parameters. The treasure quest was impossible when the ground was frozen during winters and would be very difficult in seasons of rain. This excluded half the year in western New York State. The rest of the year was taken up with long days of intense agricultural work for the farm families, and Lucy insisted that they did not neglect that labor, which was a daylight activity. So the treasure quest for the Smiths in their neighborhood occurred primarily at night, in good weather, which corresponds to most descriptions by their neighbors. However, because Joseph Jr.'s activities as stone seer brought income to the family, his parents had an incentive to allow him to pursue that activity during the daytimes, even during the spring and summer. It is unlikely that he did so only once a month, but there is no way to determine if this was even a weekly activity for the young man in his neighborhood during the agricultural seasons. Nevertheless, one of his Palmyra schoolmates specified that she was aware of his continuing the treasure quest locally for 7 years, since by all accounts he ended that activity in the fall of 1827, Samantha Payne was emphasizing the period of spring-summer 1820 to spring-summer 1827. In addition, various people in the Palmyra area stated that he was absent from home for weeks or months during those seasons. And correspondingly, residents of distant counties said that young Joseph sought buried treasure in their neighborhoods from spring to autumn. During these absences from home, Joseph Jr.'s primary activity, day and night, involved the use of seer stones. Residents along the Susquehanna River later testified that they themselves dug holes, as he directed, as early as summer 1821 for Oliver Harper, who was murdered in May 1824. The murder of the principal financier of the treasure quest along the Susquehanna River stopped those operations from the spring of 1824 to the fall of 1825. When one of Harper's former partners, Josiah Stoll, journeyed to Palmyra to beg for young Joseph's return. It is well established that, according to a written contract of Joseph Sr. with Harper's widow and his former partners, Joseph Jr. renewed his treasure seership along the Susquehanna in the fall of 1825. This resulted in his being dragged into court at Bainbridge, New York, in March 1826. Even so, Palmyra neighbors, including convert Martin Harris, claimed that the newly married adult Joseph continued to search for buried treasure locally until September 1827. Was the 10 years of mundane magic of each spring to fall from 1817 through 1827 simply a diversion from young Joseph's spiritual preparation to become a religious leader? That is how his later enemies tried to portray it, but that is not how I see it. I am firmly convinced from their post-1827 statements and activities that Joseph and his parents did not regard it as something he happily outgrew to become God's prophet and seer. First, chronologically, his experience in folk magic went hand in hand with the religious impact that Palmyra's own revivals of 1817, 1820, and 1824 had on the young man. Second, folk magic provided practical tutelage to him in seeking esoteric knowledge. Third, despite the myth of young Joseph's lack of interest in books, a myth his mother started while dictating her biography of him after his martyrdom, his adult reading and book ownership covered many fields, including such esoteric topics as Swedenborgianism and Jewish mysticism. Palmyra's book advertisements to an agricultural village during that 10 years read voraciously. Their long winter days and nights included reading books of romance, religion, biblical scholarly, philosophy, folk magic, the occult, and the esoteric. Many of the books advertised in Palmyra during his adolescence and young adulthood were in his possession the year of his death. He certainly did not repudiate this practical education in the esoteric. He used one of his treasure searching seer stones, the brown one, to translate the Book of Mormon in 1829. He used another of his treasure seeking seer stones, the white one, to dictate Revelations in 1830, one of which is in the Doctrine and Covenants, to give at least one patriarchal blessing in mid-1835. To begin his revelatory translation of the Book of Abraham in 1835, to comment on Egyptian symbols as late as February 1842, and to receive portions of a new temple endowment ceremony a few months later. In the last years of his life as LDS president, he found two more seer stones, which he showed to Brigham Young, president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. In conclusion, although the Apostle Paul often dismissed the Hebraic laws and ordinances as an inferior form of spirituality, he affirmed that the law was a schoolmaster that helped prepare the ancient Hebrews for Christianity. Likewise, 10 years of studying and practicing mundane magic served as Joseph Smith Jr.'s schoolmaster for his prophetic explorations of the metaphysical and esoteric. Thank you.
Well, Lance is coming up here. I was wondering if I could impose on Brandon to bring us some water.
In 1973, RLDS historian Paul M. Edwards identified a fundamental deficiency of Mormon historical studies. "We have not allowed," says Edwards, speaking of Mormon historians, "the revolutionary nature of the movement from which we have sprung to make us revolutionaries." He continued, "The one thing about which we might all agree concerning Joseph Smith is that he was not the usual sort of person. He did not approach life itself or his religious commitment in a usual way. Yet the character of our historical investigation of Joseph Smith and his times has been primarily traditional, unimaginative, and lacking in any effort to find or create an epistemological methodology revolutionary enough to deal with the paradox of our movement. The irony of our position is that many of our methods and interpretations have become so traditional that they can only reinforce the fears of yesterday rather than nurture the seeds of tomorrow's dreams. More than three decades now have passed since those words were penned, years marked by a veritable explosion, and then, I think, a waning in Mormon studies. And yet Edwards' challenge to find or create an epistemological methodology revolutionary enough to deal with the paradox of Joseph Smith remains a summons. Revolutions are painful processes, in measure both destructive and creative. The imaginative revisioning of Joseph's unusual approach to life and religion demands a careful, though perhaps difficult, and destructive hewing away of 100 years of encrusting vilifications and thick layerings of iconographic pigments, masks ultimately false to his lively cast. Smith eschewed orthodoxy, and so eventually must his historians. Those are the carefully selected words I used 12 years ago to open a paper I titled Joseph Smith and Kabbalah, The Occult Connection, published in Dialogue in late 1994. Over the nearly 12 years now since its publication, the steady readership, and I still get many emails from people with questions or comments or criticisms. Disappointingly, I have found over the years that not too many people seem to grasp the central focus of the work. In that paper, I was not trying to suggest that Joseph Smith was beholden to ceremonial magic or hermeticism or Kabbalah for his creative work. What I was searching to do is to find a methodology that might help historians, all of us, understand the enigma of the prophet Joseph, the puzzle of that word, prophet. Butcher, baker, candlestick maker. These are easy nomers. However humble or proud each word, each is tied to a descriptive, comprehensible social function. You may be a gluten allergic vegetarian who uses only electric lights, and yet you can still perceive through descriptive function what it would be, what it is to be a candlestick maker, a butcher, a baker. Now, that's entirely different, isn't it? In tradition, prophets are human agents of divine communication. They are the nexus between heaven and earth. In secular discourse, academic secular discourse, the word itself is delimited in a way which makes it incomprehensible, really. If you take away discussion of heaven, positing an ultimate reality beyond the material, a spiritual reality, if you take that out of the realm of your considerations, how indeed could you speak about a prophet? as anything else but, one, a person with strange psychological dispositions due to strange neurohormonal nexuses in his brain, or perhaps as a fraudulent mythmaker, a charlatan. You see, you've got a limitation there. And I myself admit to you that as a secular mind, I reached a point in my own life at about the age of 25 or 26 when I found it somewhat difficult myself to understand what it might be to be a prophet. I also, at that same time, as a result of the Mormon Historical Association meetings in Nauvoo and in Kirtland in the mid-1970s, came to understand a great deal about Joseph Smith, perhaps a great deal too much about Joseph Smith. And I found that totally out of harmony with the Orthodox Mormon myth of the man. And that, among many other forces in my life, led me pretty much to leave the Mormon heritage to which my family had cleaved for 150 years. And it led me on my own path, a path which still firmly held to a spiritual reality within the human heart. In the mid-1980s, I came into contact with the work of a fellow by the name of Carl Gustav Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist and psychologist. And over a period of several years, I undertook to read his entire 20 volumes of collected works. I found in Jung an unusual methodology, a new methodology for understanding spiritual experience. Strangely, this was an academic, one might even say secular, psychology, which valued the reality of the human spirit, the soul, the psyche. And I came to see, I came to understand, that whatever we might try to define as heaven, whatever we might have to say about the reality of prophets, there's one thing that we had to give credence to. And that is the fact that whatever those realities might be, human beings clearly had experiences of them. Clearly. Through Jung's work, I was led to the Hermetic tradition, the traditions of alchemy, and to the mystical traditions, the traditions of Islam, the Sufis, and most importantly, to the great Jewish mystical tradition of Kabbalah. Jung and his writings use these traditions as sources of evidence of a persistent human experience of divine communication, prophecy. And through these, I was led to the old Christian heresy known as Gnosticism. I had felt pretty much that I had left my Mormon phase behind. In fact, just before much of this reading and investigation started, I had moved houses, and I had thrown what now must be worth at least $3,000 or $4,000 of relatively rare Mormon books in a trash can because I didn't have enough boxes. Sometimes you have to clear the house out before you can start filling it again. But then suddenly, or maybe gradually, it dawned on me that I was coming full circle on something as I entered in to this new study. As I read through the alchemical and hermetic texts, as I studied the history and phenomenology of Jewish Kabbalah, I again and again and again began hearing echoes very familiar to me from my Mormon past. In fact, I remembered something that my father had strangely told me when I was 14. My father had said, "You know, Lance, you never need to be embarrassed about the intellectual heritage of Mormonism, because in that heritage are some of the most precious truths embraced by the Renaissance." Now, my father was a professional army officer. He was no scholar, and he was no philosopher, and I have no idea where he came up with those ideas in the early 1960s. I believe he told me that they had been suggested to him by his own mission in the South Pacific in the 1930s. Strange thoughts. They came echoing home too. And I began to see, quite aside from any external, from anyone else's suggestion that it might be so, that in Joseph Smith there was a pattern. Now, we see in the Mormon definition of the prophet, he is unique. He is a real prophet, and of course, there haven't been any other real prophets with an experience like his since ancient times. And those ancient times are delimited on two continents, of course. None in between. It's a rather idiosyncratic view. But what I discovered is a phenomenology of experience very much like Joseph Smith's. Now, of course, you have this issue of parallels. But the parallel I'm speaking about here is not of beliefs, of teachings. It's the nature of an experience. Because in the Hermetic and in the Kabbalistic traditions, there was a core belief in the reality of a communication of above and below. The traditions existed to encourage, indeed to lead, qualified individuals to the point of that communication. Within the Kabbalistic tradition, we find individuals like Abraham Abulafia in the 12th century, 13th century, seeking to bring individuals to psychological states where they could re-enter the experience of the ancient prophets. Kabbalah was not the transmission of an interpretation. Of Jewish tradition. It was a transmission of an experience. It was a way of bringing people to an experience of the divine. One found this same thing developing in Renaissance Hermetism, influenced by Kabbalah. The interesting thing I found was that many of the perceptions of these traditions coming forth from their revelatory core echoed the findings, echoed the teachings of the prophet Joseph. And then while reading the works of Gershom Scholem, the great traditional scholar of Jewish Kabbalah, I came across a very strange exegesis of the opening passages of the Zohar, the classic work of Kabbalah. And I was thunderstruck because what I found in that exegesis of the passage, according to traditional Kabbalistic interpretation, was nigh on a direct recension of Joseph Smith's King Follett Discourse. I had pretty much reached this point when a friend of mine introduced me to Michael Quinn's recent publication, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. And reading through it, all of a sudden I saw that there were connections of Joseph Smith to the Hermetic tradition. Was there also a connection to Kabbalah, I asked myself, and then I went looking. And of course, the first place to look was Alexander Neibauer. Eventually, I determined that it was likely that Neibauer had with him in Nauvoo at least a few Kabbalistic works. And I found, documented in the diaries of Neibauer and Joseph Smith both, that Neibauer was meeting with Joseph during the critical weeks and months around the time he gave the King Follett Discourse, reading with him Hebrew. Now, what sort of Hebrew would you suspect the prophet Joseph would be interested in? If Neibauer happened to have the first opening passages of the Zohar handy, do you think Joseph might have been interested as they sat and read? And what would it have taken for him to have his imagination seated with a new concept? In attempting to understand Joseph Smith and his religious vision, historians have examined both the religious sparks kindled by his time, the young prophet sprang. As useful as some of these efforts have been, I still agree with Paul Edwards. Our methods so far have been too traditional and unimaginative to comprehend Joseph's history. We remain even now blinded by yesterday's fears or biased by erroneous judgments. Chief among the subjects that might be feared in Mormon history is Joseph's apparent recurrent associations with occult traditions of Western spirituality. And this remains the area of his history least examined and understood. The historical record witnesses that Joseph Smith had some intercourse with at least three important manifestations of alternative and non-orthodox religious traditions that blossomed in the Renaissance and post-Renaissance period. Traditions sometimes labeled as a cult, ceremonial magic, masonry, Kabbalah. These associations extended throughout his life, and this liaison with each constituted more than casual acquaintance. It would be foolish at this late date to maintain that any single tradition engendered Joseph Smith's religious vision. Joseph was an American original. We need not fear him being cast as a Masonic pundit, a folk magician, a Rosicrucian mystic, a medieval Kabbalist, or an ancient Gnostic. Nonetheless, we must recognize that something in the nature of the prophet, some element of his own intrinsic vision, did resonate with the occult traditions of Western spiritual quests. Into the spirit and matter of this religious legacy, he wove his sympathies. Joseph carried his silver talisman inscribed with the sigil of Jupiter and Hebrew letters cast in a magic square, apparently upon his person, to his death. He called masonry a remnant of true priesthood, and over 1,000 of his men in Nauvoo, including nearly every then current or future priesthood leader of the nascent church, went through the three separate ritual steps of initiation, leading to the degree of Master Mason. Symbols derived from that legacy came to decorate his temple and the seal of his apostles. In his last months, amid dissension and danger, he apparently found time to sit and read Hebrew and perhaps study some fragments of Kabbalah and the opening words of the Zohar with Alexander Neibauer. In April 1844, when his congregation expected retrenchment and reconciliation, he turned to that Hebrew and he bequeathed to his disciples an extraordinary vision of God, a theosophical pronouncement which echoed the tones of Kabbalah, even to the ear of a critic so far removed in time and culture as dear Harold Bloom. It is this last link, Joseph's sympathy for Kabbalah, which may be the key that finally unlocks a path ending the prophet Joseph. As Richard Bushman noted, in his book, The Beginnings of Mormonism. The power of Enlightenment skepticism had far less influence on Joseph. Joseph told of visits of angels of direct inspiration of a voice in the chamber of Father Whitmer without embarrassment. He prized the Urim and Thummim and the Seer Stone, never repudiating them, even when the major charge against him was that he used magic to find buried treasure. His world was not created by Enlightenment rationalism, with its deathly aversion to superstition. The prophet brought into modern America elements of more ancient culture, in which the sacred and the profane intermingled, and the saints enjoyed supernatural gifts and powers as frequent blessings of an interested God. Joseph did bring into America elements of an ancient culture, but that culture was not temporally very distant from the prophet. When Joseph Smith was introduced to the fragments of Jewish Kabbalah in Nauvoo, if he was, he found, consciously or unconsciously, the fiber of a thread woven throughout the fabric of his life. The magic he met as a youth, the prophetic interpretation of Scripture, and the ongoing opening of the canon of divine revelation, the Masonic symbol system, all of these were reflections of a heterodox, hermetic, religious tradition that had persisted in various occult fashions within Western religious imagination for centuries, a tradition of which Kabbalah was a most important part. Call the tradition occult if you wish. Certainly to survive at times it was hidden. But do not err by seeing it as simply a legacy of ideas from which the young prophet might pick and choose. The tradition, as is now well accepted by scholars, was driven by a phenomenon of a rare human experience. As interwoven into Hermeticism, Kabbalah was a tradition not just of theosophic assertions, but of return to prophetic vision. For a millennia or more, perhaps dating all the way back to the suppressed heresy of the Gnostics, men and women within this larger tradition asserted the reality of their vision, and sometimes even used what now seem modern psychological insights in dealing with their very real experiences. Individuals caught in this experience not uncommonly saw themselves as prophets, though the force of the tradition sought to maintain a balance in the face of such realizations. Many of them thought themselves kings and queens before God, and some openly proclaimed their loyalty. They probed the mystery of Adam and Eve and primal creation. They embraced rituals and symbols as non-verbal expressions of ineffable insights. Their sexuality was sacralized, and not infrequently, their sacred sexual practices ranged beyond the bounds of expression accepted by the societies of their times. Their most sacred mystery, the great Mysterium Conjunctionis, was something ecstatically mirrored in the holy union of a man and a woman. They authored pseudo-epigraphic works. They invoked ancient voices as their own. They told new stories about God because for them God was a living story, and they found their own lives mingled with a story being told by a living God. If Joseph sought a mirror to understand himself, he might have found reflections in a history not so distant as that of ancient Israel. His story, the prophet's story, lived within the occult legacy of his times, and he touched that legacy often. And he arguably saw in it the image, even if dimmed and distorted, of a priesthood he shared. Joseph's life reflected the nature of an unusual human experience. And to understand his history, we must understand his experience in the context of history. The Swiss psychologist Carl Jung dedicated the last half of his long life to elucidating the nature and psychological insights of the Kabbalistic, Hermetic, alchemical tradition. He felt it held the pearl of great price, the treasure forgotten by Christianity in its enlightened Protestant evolution. It was at the Uranos conferences, dominated by Jung, that Gershom Scholem has opened the eyes of Western scholarship to the tradition's import in our history. Moshe Edel, Scholem's brilliant and independent protege, has subsequently the value of a psychological perception in understanding its phenomena. With insights augmented by Scholem's work, the historian Francis Yates pioneered a new understanding of the vast influences of the occult tradition in Renaissance and Reformation culture. And more recently, Harold Bloom has pointed to its import in the creative vision of more modern times. Perhaps the thrust of this scholarship is now reaching the cloisters of Mormon history. But should that be the case, Mormon historians, historians of Mormonism, must understand that they are embarking into a different methodology of history. A prophet's history flows from two springs. One above and one below. Both melding in currents of his life. What story from above the prophet may have heard will remain his secret. The history no man knows. But by turning to the larger realm of prophetic history and its occult legacy, the record of its aspirations, its symbols and lore, and the enigmatic of the women and men who have been caught in this unique human experience, we may begin to find and amplify a methodology that leads us with new wonder into the unknown history of Joseph Smith. Thank you.
I would like to thank you all for being here. I'm honored to be here at the invitation of the Sunstone Foundation. As an amateur and erstwhile devotee of Mormon studies, but a long time Mormon, and an erstwhile practicing Mormon, I am very pleased that someone thinks I might have something to contribute on the topic of that great original Latter-day Saint, Joseph Smith, Jr. I'd like to start off saying a few words about my own relationship to Joseph Smith. My Joseph Smith may be different from your own, or Harold Bloom's. I agree very much with Lance Owens that Joseph Smith is one of a kind. I would like to remember the ingenious cartoonist whose name escapes me, who published in Sunstone some years ago a diagram of the Mormon brain or Mormon mind as something like a pie cut into pieces, in which the largest piece, approximately 35%, was labeled Joseph Smith. There's been a section of my mind comprised by Joseph Smith, his teachings and the awareness of them. Possibly not in the shape of a piece of pie. As someone remarked earlier, Maxine, I believe, I'm particularly cognizant at the moment of the shape of at least the seat of my mind because of the surgery I've recently undergone. It crossed my mind this morning when I had the good fortune to receive by fax a very carefully husbanded copy of the talk by Richard L. Bushman mentioned by Maxine. I think it goes without saying these days that almost everyone has her own Joseph Smith. What I have to say might not be as clearly focused as the two fine talks we have just heard, but I think at the same time that my remarks will remain relevant, as I am not entirely oblivious of what is going on in the reappraisal of our dear founding prophet. Clearly, Joseph Smith has had his share of bad press through the years, much of it in the last 50 years and from within, or 60 years, might be closer, and much of it from within the community which he himself founded and launched. I recall thinking at one point, after returning to Utah following the decade of the 70s, most of which I had spent abroad studying in Western Europe, that it might not be amiss to characterize the persistent fascination over Joseph Smith in some quarters, including the minds and the thinking and the speech of skeptics, including even rather toxic naysayers in our midst. Might be characterized metaphorically as a crater caused by the explosion of Joseph Smith's mind, thought, and works, around which stood many somewhat amazed and even stupefied people staring into that crater, wondering what had happened. Well, I think that the crater is still there, and as well as a lot of naysayers, but things have changed greatly, a fact borne out and by the existence of this panel. I would like to emphasize a few words about Mike Quinn's early Mormonism and the magic worldview. When I read that book, I remember recalling said by Immanuel Kant or David Hume, I forget which, one of the notable European philosophers of the late 18th century, to the effect that having read Rousseau, he had been roused from his dogmatic slumber. I remember thinking that reading Quinn, I had been roused from my Jack Mormon slumber and suddenly saw my heritage with new eyes, found it freshly fascinating, riveting, and full of far more interest than I had supposed during the previous 20 or 25 years. It would be difficult to overestimate or overstate the influence of that contribution to Mormon history and to the appreciation of the prophet Joseph Smith. A couple of things that book opened up to me. One of these is what I have referred to somewhere in some article or other as a syncretism. The fact that Mormonism emerges on reexamination as a syncretistic religious movement. Now this to some people is not a good thing, might be a bad thing. The true believer, content with the laundered history we all grew up on, for example, might think that inimical to the true prophetic character of Joseph Smith. Well, it may well be inimical to the misperceived and oversimplified, non-comprehensive view of the career of Joseph Smith, but I believe it speaks highly of his creativity and resourcefulness that Mike and Lance and others have been able to discern roots of Mormon theocracy, theology, cosmology, and doctrine in general in sources remote from New England, from Western New York. I think many people, including Richard Bushman, would agree that this is all to the good because it helps liberate Joseph Smith from the confines of a strictly naturalistic history of or context, historical context, by means of which to attempt to explain Joseph Smith. John Butler spoke, I believe, in a review of that work of Mike's, of the fact that it opened up a history or a genealogy of texts reaching back into early European sources that Mike had discerned some of these things in his study of the occult interests and practices of Joseph and of the Smith family. Lance clearly was also affected by this work, and of course I dwelt on it because I had the privilege to review it for BYU studies. But that was only one thing that fascinated me about that work, and Lance mentioned another one, which I'm about to mention, which impressed me greatly. And that is the ways in which the immersion in the magic worldview seemed to have improved our chances of getting in touch with the heavens. I believe we shouldn't worry about this or being a feeling that we're tainted by having the occult in our history, because although some in our midst have found Joseph to have been all too human, I believe I called him the greatest figure in our spiritual heritage. We found him to be all too human. Yet for many thousands, and perhaps we could now say millions, he put the living God back into religion. And I believe other scholars have contested the arbitrary separation which has been maintained long since in Christendom between religion and magic. Thank you very much.
There isn't much time left, but I'm going to quickly summarize, I think, a few thoughts that I had. I'm not sure that we'll have much time for question and answer. I wanted to share a few ideas about Joseph as myth maker, Joseph working in the realm of myth. This is my Joseph, the one I relate to. Joseph has usually been critiqued or analyzed by scholars coming from a rational critique or point of view. In fact, I found it interesting when Dan Vogel said, "I want to know Joseph's truth." I thought that was beautifully expressed, and yet the approach is more of a rational approach. And I wonder, can we really know Joseph's truth unless we experience what Joseph experienced? Or unless we share his typology or personality or pathology? Can we really know Joseph's truth without experiencing the same mental states he experienced? I think knowing Joseph's truth is knowing both sides of the man or all of the man. And I think that as a mystic or a person who makes myth or participates in the mythic realm, I think it takes one to know one. In other words, I think one has to be a mystic oneself or participate in the mythic framework oneself to understand Joseph's myth-making or mythic or mystic side. I'm not sure that those who never enter the mythic realm can understand that side of Joseph, and I'm not sure that they can critique that side of Joseph not experiencing it. This was well said by Robert Remini, who said, "I was a historian. How was I going to address this man's claims to vision? I had to look for the facts of his life and find the rational reasons for the beliefs and actions of the individual." Many Mormons, particularly Orthodox Mormons, are uncomfortable with the word myth in connection with Joseph, and also in connection with the Book of Mormon. They prefer to see the Book of Mormon as a literal history, because they think that if the Book of Mormon is a literal history rather than a mythic story, it's somehow more true or more real. I would say that myth occupies a middle realm of the psyche, between the spiritual realm and the physical realm. It is the place, the psyche or the soul is the place of dynamic interaction between spirit and body. And this is where myth emerges in archetype, symbol, archetypal patterns. Religions arise from this middle realm, although they are born in the realm of spirit, where one's own spirit or the pneumatic self has an encounter with its source, with the divine, with pure truth, which is a mystery. Yet the formation of a religion or religious forms arises often in the psyche, where after having had that spiritual experience, the nature, character, and images of God and heavenly realms emerge as realms between the source of light and truth and the human being. I wanted to share a reading from the Gospel of Philip, which says, "Truth did not come into the world naked, but it came in types and images. The world will not receive truth any other way. There is a rebirth and an image of a rebirth. It is certainly necessary to be born again through this image, resurrection. The image must rise again through the image." Philip goes on to say that Jesus did not appear as he was, but in the manner in which they would be able to see him. He appeared to them all. He appeared to the great as great. He appeared to the small as small. He appeared to the angels as an angel and to men as a man. And he made the disciples great that they might be able to see him in his greatness. So there's a difference between mysticism and myth, in that the mystic is experiencing the source or the pure spiritual truth, and the myth or the myth maker is telling that experience to himself. Yet both transcend body, place, and time, and both are inner processes. I wanted to quote Carl Jung also, just quickly. He talks about archetype as being the unconscious contents or the contents of the unconscious self. Archetypes are those psychic contents which have not yet been submitted to conscious elaboration. Their immediate manifestation as we encounter it in dreams and visions is much more individual. Archetype is essentially an unconscious content that is altered by becoming conscious and by being perceived. And it takes its color from the individual consciousness in which it happens to appear. He also says that archetypes cannot be integrated simply by rational means, but require a dialectical procedure, an inner colloquy with one's good angel. Usually the process runs a dramatic course with many ups and downs. He also says a well-known expression of archetype is myth. So these descriptions describe, I think, Joseph to a great extent, not entirely, but the process that Joseph had, Joseph Smith entering into a dialogue with the mystic or the spiritual experience, and coming out with expressions, mythic expressions of what that was. We are just about out of time, and I wanted to summarize just a couple of other things really quickly. I wanted to mention the Book of Mormon as myth in a good sense, not in the sense of myth as a made-up story or a piece of fiction, but myth in the sense that one's consciousness is bringing forth things from the unconscious, and that myth is an experience of another realm. In fact, I see parallels between the Book of Mormon and I hope you'll forgive me, The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien's work, both being mythic works, both being works whose writers, or in the case of Joseph Smith, translator, experienced as the telling of a story about an ancient place and time in America, a place that they felt they visited in their interaction with the mythic realm, and that they came back to tell. Interestingly enough, Harold Bloom compared the Book of Mormon to Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. He said that when he was reading Lord of the Rings, what it reminded him most of was the Book of Mormon. I don't have time to really give the rest of the points that I was going to make, but essentially what I had wanted to say was that the Book of Mormon works as myth, a conveyor of truth. Truth come into the world in form. And that I think the Book of Mormon fits all the criteria for true myth. I think a question we have to ask ourselves is the Book of Mormon a good myth or a bad myth? There are a number of aspects of the Book of Mormon that would give it a qualification of bad myth. But it also has a number of good aspects. So I would say the Book of Mormon is both good myth and bad myth. An example of good myth would be Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. An example of a bad myth would be Hitler's mythology. Hitler, who was a myth maker, created a myth that damaged or harmed. I think there are aspects of the Book of Mormon that are harmful and damaging, along with aspects of the Book of Mormon that are ennobling and inspiring and uplifting. Tom Murphy has pointed out the danger of the Book of Mormon as a myth that Christianizes Native peoples and projects Christianity backward in time onto Native Americans, and that is a concern. That is an aspect of the Book of Mormon as a bad myth, in my opinion. However, I wanted to say that 30 years ago this summer, I first read the Book of Mormon and Lord of the Rings that same summer as my summer reading, my first year after college, and I found that I entered both as a mythic place. I entered the myth when I read the Book of Mormon, and I entered the myth when I read Lord of the Rings, and I found that time and place faded, melted, and I was there. I was there with Bilbo when he fought the dragon. I was there with Frodo going to Mordor and coming home. And at the end of Lord of the Rings, I found myself lying on the floor and weeping with the fellowship as they parted. And the same thing was true of the Book of Mormon. I was there when Nephi cut off Laban's head and saw the blood gushing. I remember shivering in terror at the image of Shiz rising up on his arms after being beheaded in one last gasp. I was there with Moroni, alone and lonely at the end of his people.